Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and for those of you listening at home, if you are living with your parents, how much are you worried about having to be on your own? Maybe you don't want to leave. Maybe you're anxious to get out. Later this hour, we're going to have the story of a mom and her daughter with autism preparing for her life as a young, independent person. It can be really tough out there on your own under any circumstances. We'll take a look at what the fears are going forward. Also, being a woman online can be a little disconcerting if you try internet dating. We'll look today at a dating site designed for women that encourages women to make the first move. But we begin in eastern Ukraine, where a battle rages in the city of Debaltseve. Listen.
There's just nowhere for us to go. Do you understand? We have nowhere to live and nowhere else to go. We have two children. We couldn't evacuate them. We're the last ones left. Debaltseve has been surrounded for 6 months. We don't have electricity, gas or water. Please, people out there, help us.
It's a woman trapped in the city speaking on the BBC. As the Russian economy shows signs of some pain from lower oil prices and Western sanctions, the pro-Russian forces in Ukraine have raised the tension on the ground, pounding Ukrainian army positions in the east of the country after the latest round of peace talks failed to halt the violence that has killed more than 5,000 people. The rebels announced a mobilization plan which they said would boost their forces to over 100,000 men, and Ukraine's military chief plans to add an extra 50,000 fighters. Since the conflict began a year ago, the United States has refused to send arms or military advisors to Ukraine, but now the White House is looking at providing Ukrainian forces with defensive weapons and equipment in the face of the rebel offensive. And Secretary of State John Kerry plans to head to Kiev on Thursday. Joining us now from the city of Kharkiv in northeastern Ukraine is Andriy Kulikov, Public Radio Ukraine correspondent and host of a major political talk show on ICTV in Ukraine, Ukraine Public Radio. Welcome back, Andriy.
Thank you for having me on Takeaway.
How do you assess the apparent escalation that's taken place in the last week or so in eastern Ukraine?
As many, many people in Ukraine, I assess it with great pain and a great concern over the future of the country. I think that there's quite a lot of determination on the part of rebel forces to continue onslaught. And there's not as much force on the government side as they would want to make us believe as to successfully counteract the offensive. To my mind, the rebel forces and rebel leaders are directly instigated and supported by the Russian rulers. And what we need now in Ukraine is most of all determination and staunchness, not to get into panic, and in spite of the aggravation of combat action, still try to seek a peaceful resolution for the matter.
What do you make of the apparent siege of Debaltseve, whose town is completely surrounded? We've been getting very harrowing reports of people trapped inside.
What is happening in Ukraine is a great humanitarian disaster and human tragedy. No matter on which side of the front line those peaceful people are, they suffer most of all. Again, this is why we have to seek a peaceful solution. But if we don't dwell or if we don't concentrate on the humanitarian aspect, then Debaltseve and some other points and settlements are very important for both sides to demonstrate what they can do. It is paramount to rebels now to try to win as much territory from government-controlled forces as possible, and at the same time it is very important for the Ukraine's government to hold their ground. Many people think that President Poroshenko's proclaimed policy of seeking truce with the rebels, that his policy was a mistake. People say that while Ukrainian forces were not engaging in active combat, we lost a lot of territory and we still continue to lose lives. Other people say that this truce still gave Ukraine an opportunity to reinforce the army and to be more successful, if there's any rate of success, in resisting the enemy offensive.
We very much are grateful and rely on your reports for what's going on in Ukraine and in eastern Ukraine. But some people have remarked that you seem to be very much associated with the Ukrainian side of the story. How would you answer the charge that you're not objective in this conflict, Andriy?
I don't know. I think that if my reporting for The Takeaway helps to better understand the situation and in the final end helps to save at least one life, then I am satisfied. If on the other side I do not succeed in this, then I will have to try better.
Do you think a peaceful settlement is conceivable this year, Andriy?
Well, peaceful settlement is conceivable always. It is always desirable. And the matter is on which terms the peaceful settlement is going to happen. I do not believe that Russia has reached its final goal, about which I have my personal opinion. I think that Ukraine might stop engaging in combat if we are given real guarantees that there won't be encroachments and the breach of ceasefire from the other side.
Andriy Kulyakov, Public Radio Ukraine correspondent, host of a major political talk show on ICTV in Ukraine, Ukraine Public Radio. Andriy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So what is the thought in Moscow about this conflict? Here's a story Putin's biographer Natalia Kevorkian told on Frontline about a young Vladimir Putin who cornered a rat one time and never forgot what happened.
He said that I learned very good. I learned forever. Don't try to push somebody into the corner. They will jump. Because when you don't have what to lose, you attack. When he's in the corner, that's why he's dangerous. He can jump. He will not say, okay, let's talk. He will jump.
With oil prices down 50% and the ruble losing more than half its value, Russia and Putin may be feeling cornered. Putin, the hardline former KGB agent with access to over 8,000 nuclear warheads, is he identifying with that cornered rat of long ago right about now? George Friedman is the CEO of Stratfor and author most recently of Flashpoints, The Emerging Crisis in Europe. He says it's the long view that matters most when you look at Europe and especially Russia.
Russia has never been successfully invaded and occupied for an extended period of time. At the same time, it has been invaded. It needs buffers. The traditional buffer is the line, the Baltics, Belarus, Ukraine. It sees, it reads what happened in Kiev as the following. The legitimately elected president of Ukraine, no one doubts that he won the election, Yanukovych won the election, refused to sign a treaty with the Europeans, which was his right. He came home to demonstrations, perfectly legitimate. The United States very openly supported the demonstrators, gave money through the National Endowment for Democracy and other things. And a group of demonstrators nullified the results of the election. And the United States supported this. Now, the Americans have another story, which is that Yanukovych was corrupt and so on and had to be disposed of. But look from the Russian point of view, the question is, why did the Americans do this? Why would the Americans be so interested in Kiev? And the answer they come up with is the Americans are extending their power far to the east, nearly to Stalingrad, to Volgograd, to 300 miles away from Moscow, because they want the Russian Federation to fragment, to put it in an impossible position. This narrative has elements of truth to it, fable in it, but it is the Russian view. Now, the Americans have recently gone, the general in charge of the American army in Europe went to Kiev, announced that there would be American trainers coming in on the ground, then announced that we would be prepositioning armor and artillery in the Baltics, in Poland, and in Romania. This is freaking the Russians out. They look at this as the United States having made a strategic decision to undermine the Russia, by prepositioning forces, that they have moved into the Ukraine. The Russians have failed miserably. I mean, their intelligence service completely miscalculated everything that was happening in Kiev, and they fired a great many of the experts. And they've also announced a restructuring of the FSB, of the intelligence service. The Russians are facing an economic crisis of epic proportions because they're dependent on energy, and energy prices have collapsed. The sanctions don't help. They're not that damaging. And so the Russians are now desperate. When Russia gets desperate, that's when it becomes the most dangerous. And as a Russian told me on a recent visit, look, we know what poverty is like. We lived through it in the 90s. For us, prosperity is the extraordinary thing. But just remember, our economy was in a shambles, but we won World War II. We were very good in these situations. So you have a situation where Russia cannot permit what is happening to happen. And the Americans can't permit the Russians from coming back because their primordial fear is a European hegemon, someone uniting the entire European continent under them. Once they have the Ukraine, what's to stop them from going to Romania? What's to stop them from going to Russia? So you have two deep and legitimate fears confronting each other, but it's asymmetric. For the Americans, it's a fear, but not a hysteria. For the Russians, it's everything. So the question is, what does Putin do? Not because he's Putin. He could be any Russian leader has got to respond to the Ukraine. And in the middle of it are the Ukrainians, deeply divided themselves, talking about national self-determination. And then the argument comes in the East, which really is overwhelmingly Russian and doesn't like Kiev. Well, what about our national self-determination? So we are now in a position that have been in so many times for hundreds of years where the West, now in the form of the United States, is confronting Russia, and the Russians have nothing but bad choices, and they'll make one, and we won't like it.
One of those bad choices is nukes.
It is a choice, but my fear is not that they're going to go to nuclear war. My fear is that pressure will be put on Russia so that it actually fragments, so that it goes the way of the Soviet Union, so that Moscow no longer can control the provinces. Then what happens to the nukes out in the provinces? I'm not worried that the Russians are crazy enough to use nuclear weapons. I am worried that the fragmentation of Russia, while in the short run an interesting opportunity for the United States, raises a very serious question. What in the world is going to happen to those nukes if chaos breaks out in Russia?
George Friedman is the founder and CEO of Stratfor and author most recently of Flashpoints, The Emerging Crisis in Europe. Tomorrow, more from George Friedman and the shifting centers of power in Europe.
Turkey has arisen again, partly because everybody else has collapsed. Turkey can't exist with 360-degree chaos. And Turkey has an army of 1 million people. And it's desperately trying to get the Americans to do the job for them or anyone else. And the Americans are now refusing to do this without them.
A conversation from the land of the Sun King in France to the land of the Ottoman Sultan. That's tomorrow on The Takeaway. You might call these two voices bookends of U.S. policy in Central America.
But let us be clear as to the American attitude toward the government of Nicaragua. We do not seek its overthrow.
General Noriega's reckless threats and attacks upon Americans in Panama created an imminent danger to the 35,000 American citizens in Panama.
Ronald Reagan in 1983 outlining his aggressive policy against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and George H.W. Bush announcing the invasion of Panama to overthrow the government of Manuel Noriega. Back then, U.S. policy and leverage in Central America involved military aid, like the aid now being considered for Ukraine. U.S. clout in Central America also depended on support of some questionable military dictators during the Cold War. President Obama is asking Congress for $1 billion to help Central America in his current budget. But what kind of leverage does the U.S. have now that the old leaders and the old Cold War missions in that region are gone? Cynthia Arnson is the director of the Latin American program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C.
During the 1980s, the U.S. effort was definitely aimed at defeating the insurgencies, particularly in El Salvador, to a lesser extent in Guatemala, because the human rights situation was so bad that Congress had cut off military aid, and also in undermining the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, which was a guerrilla movement that had overthrown a dictator that had been supported by the United States for many years. The internal armed conflicts came to an end in the 1990s, and there was an effort by the international community to contribute to development assistance, to reform of the armed forces and the police, and to get elites to pay higher taxes. And the aid and attention really sort of dissipated over the course of the 1990s. And of course, by the end of that decade during the Clinton administration, Colombia became the central focus of U.S. policy in the hemisphere. Central America very much slipped off the radar screen. And there were terrible problems of violence. There were underlying structural problems that were never addressed. And those are the kinds of issues now that have come into the forefront. The real wake-up call was the crisis of unaccompanied children flooding across the U.S. border that peaked over the summer in June and July of this past year. And I think it led U.S. policymakers, the U.S. public, to focus once again on the terrible violence, the problems of economic exclusion, of a lack of jobs and opportunities that have been the major drivers behind this unprecedented wave of child migration.
Do you believe that $1 billion can address those structural issues, or will that money fuel the pre-existing corruption and that more of an investment is really required?
Corruption is definitely an issue, but I think there will be some gains that will be possible with those kinds of resources. But it's not just a question of resources. It's a question of leadership and of a political will to make the difficult changes and implement the much deeper reforms that the whole region needs, or particularly the Northern Triangle.
What's the picture look like country to country if we're to make plans in dealing with a changing relationship in Nicaragua versus Guatemala? And might there be an opportunity to work with partners in the hemisphere as opposed to doing it unilaterally?
There are certainly efforts to work with partners in the hemisphere. The main development institution, the Inter-American Development Bank, is very heavily engaged with trying to create opportunities for young people, improving education, improving technical and vocational skills so that people have a future. The main focus of this aid package is on the three countries of what's referred to as the Northern Triangle: El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, where the problems of crime and violence and of lack of opportunity, lack of growth, are the most extensive. Each country is different, though. The problems in Guatemala involve a lot of exclusion of the 50 or so percent of the population that's of indigenous origin. In El Salvador, there is a terrible and resurgent problem of gang violence, although El Salvador has made a lot more progress than its neighbors, in part because of the Millennium Challenge Corporation partnership that it has had with the U.S. government that sets out clear objectives and measurements of how those objectives are being met. Honduras has made some important improvements in controlling its borders, especially its northern border, which has become a key corridor for drug trafficking. But in all three countries, the ability of organized crime to have taken root also depends on penetration and corruption of the existing structures of the police, of the court system, even some parts of civil society and the political system. So it's going to be very, very difficult to simply come in with an aid package and eradicate that deep sort of sense of influence and penetration of those systems. And that is going to be a very key challenge, which is why transparency is going to be such an important component of reestablishing the rule of law.
Finally, some have said that with the parallels demand for drugs in the United States, that it's going to be very difficult to use traditional aid to reform institutions in Central America, that the money might better be spent on reducing the demand side of the drug market in the United States, that would be the biggest contributor to reform in Central America.
There have been some important reductions in drug consumption in the United States, but of course, Central America and Mexico and the Caribbean have somewhat of an advantage, but also the tremendous disadvantage in this case of being the neighbors of the largest consuming drug population in the world. It is not the case, even though certain states in the United States and certain countries in Latin America have experimented with the legalization of marijuana consumption, that is just not going to be a part of the picture with cocaine and heroin. And those are the drugs that are corrupting these political systems and institutions, even if it's important to step up the treatment and prevention and inclusion opportunities in the United States to further lower demand. That is not alone going to be sufficient. There have to be very, very strong efforts to reform the systems in those three countries.
Cynthia Aronson is Director of Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I float as the clouds on air do.
Ah, yes, a very dated song from the 1950s. These days, enjoying being a girl can be the relief when you have a trusted girlfriend to talk to about the irresistible scourge of one's 20s and 30s, dating. That's why Marnie and Hannah from the series Girls are glad to have each other to talk about Adam. Well, sort of glad to have each other.
How's New York?
It's really good. And don't start.
Don't start with what?
I just know that you're going to try to talk to me about Adam right now, and you're going to be subtle about it. Don't. Start. I'm not going to tell you.
I didn't want to talk about Adam until you brought Adam up. I mean, how is Adam?
Okay, so down deep, they are glad they have each other. In this next part of our series, Being a Woman Online, we're looking at how the internet permits communities of comfort to develop, even when there's no real sense of place. Women like the candor of online communities far more than conversations in bars or during quick work breaks. One such community is actually a dating site called Siren, a new app co-founded by developer Susie Lee, dedicated to the idea that when women know the community is free of creeps and is all about respect and empowerment, dating online for women becomes a lot more fun and interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there still is a little bit of stigma of, say, you know, 10 years ago when people would assume that the reason that you're on a dating site is because you don't have the social skills to meet people, you know, in real life. And that is absolutely not the case right now. And if you, you know, are professional and working anywhere from 40 to 60 hours a week, the last thing I think a lot of people want to do is then kind of suit up and go to a bar and meet somebody. In addition, you don't necessarily, as a woman, want to mix your professional and personal lives. So what we thought is we want to take the strength of online dating, which is collapsing the kind of physical boundaries that separate, you know, the architects from the lawyers, and say this is a really beautiful and potentially interesting way to meet people that are outside of your social circle. But the problem is that if you are that female lawyer and your client sees you on this online space, suddenly you are faced with an awkward situation of somebody knowing something about you that's not really relevant to your professional dynamic, and it still compromises the woman's identity because she can't be easily a sexual person and a professional person in people's eyes.
So men may be more comfortable with the kind of ranking, you know, browsing, broad sort of search strategy. Women are much more selective is sort of the operating assumption you're making here.
I think so. I think that one of the issues that we have right now is that there is this shopping mentality. There's a complexity of individuals that we wanted to explore, but our culture currently isn't really an and kind of culture. It's an or. So even when women are presented online, they're either this or that. Mm-hmm. And the same goes with men. And we didn't think that that was actually a good way to even start, you know, signals of interest or to discover whether or not there's any kind of chemistry between two people.
Since chemistry is so important, how does the online world project, in your view, chemistry?
So a lot of current models think that chemistry can be determined algorithmically. Answer 50 multiple choice questions and you'll be able to figure out, some kind of computer program will be able to figure out what a perfect match is for you. I think we all sort of know that, you know, probably most of us have that relationship which looks great on paper and which oftentimes is pretty disastrous in real life.
I am intrigued by this idea of online chemistry and the idea of being a woman or a girl online, because I have three girls who have very distinct online personalities. That's for sure. I'm just wondering if you think that the key to all of this has something to do with being vulnerable but being safe at the same time, that that's really the paradigm, the predicament of the online world for women in a dating context.
Absolutely. And there is a parallel to, you know, actually the physical world, which is simply that if you don't feel safe in a space, then you can't let down your guard and actually show different parts of yourself. There is, you know, especially in an online dating platform where you are trying to let down your guard and be vulnerable to someone else, but also allowing women to have this profile visibility control, it meant that if they made one step forward and felt a little bit uncomfortable, they could always step back if they needed to, or they could sort of negotiate something that that felt a little more safe online.
In your iPhone launch, what was the mix of sign-up, or what has been the mix of sign-up?
It varies anywhere from 55% women to 45% men, or 60-40. I think what we really love about our community so far is that the men on the site do recognize that this is a model that could work for women, and we've had a lot of great feedback from the men that said we appreciate this, that we are not the kind of men that are interested in objectifying women or reducing them to some kind of common stereotype. And the women love it because they think this is actually a way that I would love to be able to meet people even in real life, which is respectfully, and that I am allowed to give signals of interest that then the men respond to.
Is online a great place to be a woman?
I think that if there are more women contributing to the platforms out there, it absolutely can be. As a woman, this is your first foray into this space and you get this kind of a barrage of unwanted comments, you know, your option is going to be the same as any other one, which is, I don't want to do this anymore. And I do remember actually testing that. And so, you know, before launching Siren, you know, creating accounts in different sites and thinking, ooh, this is no good. But thinking there absolutely is a potential to be better. So I just thought, sure, as a woman, technology is a fairly inexpensive thing to do. So why not jump in and contribute something positive to the space?
That's great. Susie Lee, co-founder of the dating app Siren. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
We've been getting some great tweets on all of this. Reed Rutt says, being a woman is fantastic, particularly online, where showcasing our splendiferous capabilities begets reverence and power. Perfect.
Hi, this is Medina Cardona calling from Portland, Oregon. As a trans person of color, the internet can be a scary place, but social media has been, it continues to be, the driving force for change and for equality and for visibility and for creating those desperately needed safe spaces, which in turn empower our communities even further.
This is Derek from Oconee, Illinois. I met my wife on the internet and we've been married for 15 happy years. I think it's a great thing.
Congratulations, and keep the calls coming. You know, you can join us tomorrow online for a Twitter chat on this subject. For more details, visit thetakeaway.org. We always want to hear from you. Tweet us at The Takeaway and follow me at Jay Hockenberry. For 20-year-old college student Ondine Grosser, there's a milestone besides dating that she sees down the road, and she's pretty comfortable talking about it.
It's probably about 5 years from now, but I know I'm going to have to move out eventually. And that means doing practically everything on my own, which is kind of a scary prospect.
It's scary because Ondine Grosser has lived on what's called the autism spectrum all her life. She's intelligent, high-performing, but can be withdrawn. Social situations can overwhelm her, like they did when she went to Knox College in Illinois. Ondine and her mother, Amira, thought it would work out, but it didn't.
I've never failed anything before. I've always gotten, like A pluses and A's in high school, so I was not accustomed to getting F's and withdrawing.
Ondine and her mom, Amira, were also not accustomed to the relative lack of support for young adults on the autism spectrum. Today, Ondine is at a community college and much better off because of a program called Aspire that's specifically designed to help high-functioning adults with autism. There aren't many of these programs. This one is run by Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Ondine, her mom Amira, and Jennifer Richler, a science writer and clinical psychologist, talked with us about the challenges for autistic adults and, as Amira told us, how she missed all the warning signs during that first college experience.
You know, we thought we did things right when Ondine had her acceptances. We drove to the Midwest and visited a number of colleges that she was accepted to and spoke to the disability departments. And I think in this case, because at the end of the year when I picked up Ondine's sister, who also went to Knox and is also on the spectrum, the lady, who's a lovely, lovely lady, but she apologized to me basically saying she was in over her head. And even though when we had gone the previous year, she had said, oh, she was up on all the latest research, that was not actually true. She hadn't had any continuing ed. She didn't know any of the new supports or anything out there that is recommended for children on the spectrum to be successful in college. And I mean, frankly, I should have done more on my own. Ondine had been in an out-of-district placement, and I sort of had let the school sort of handle everything, thinking, well, you know, she's all set. But that really wasn't the case. I really needed to be much more proactive and much more of an advocate. And I mean, the other thing is, a lot of colleges and a lot of schools in general, when you have kids on the spectrum who have social difficulties but are very, very bright academically and intellectually, it's very hard for them to gauge what kind of supports these kids need, because very often they look and they see, oh, they'll get an A in a class or on a test, and they think, oh, they don't need any supports. But there are a lot of invisible supports that are put in place that parents do all the time without even realizing it, with cueing kids. Oh, you know, did you remember to put this in your backpack, or did you remember to do this? And without that, very often kids miss out.
Jennifer, you're hearing this story. Does it sound familiar, and does it generally really state the case for what's gone on in the United States for people on the autism spectrum? As adults who don't get as much attention or expertise as they got as children?
I think it definitely does tell a pretty representative story about adults on the autism spectrum, and especially adults like Ondine, who are really bright and have a lot of strengths. And as Amira pointed out, that sometimes makes people less attuned to the challenges they face and the supports that they might need in order to thrive. So I think it does tell a story that I hear a lot. I do think that part of why this is an interesting time for adults with autism is that maybe the picture is starting to change just a little bit as more and more people with autism are entering adulthood, and particularly many adults who are on the milder end of the autism spectrum. So they are bright, they have a lot of abilities and strengths, but they struggle with some of the same things that anyone with autism does, the social interaction piece, keeping organized and on top of things. But I am starting to see signs of programs that are really tailored to serving that exact population. And I think with more of those programs and better training for the staff who run them, we're going to start to see better stories and more encouraging stories unfolding.
What is it that you've noticed that's different, Amira, about Ondine since she's gotten involved in these other adult-oriented programs?
I think when Ondine came back, she was emotionally quite traumatized, and she sort of spent almost 2 months sort of in her room just kind of recalibrating and just kind of venturing out a little bit to see that, you know, society's not going to, push her down, that she can. There is a place for her. And when we contacted the A&E, which is the Asperger's Association of New England, and Aspire, where Ondine, prior to going off to college, had done a couple of summers in their program for teenagers, they helped her really kind of get out of her shell and start to talk to people again and to look for a future. When she first came home, she said to me that she has no future, that, you know, that she's a whole hopeless and a failure, and that, you know, there's nothing for her. And then to finally come to the point where she's now She made the dean's list this past semester, and she's doing really well in her DNA biotechnology courses, you know, and talking to people and strangers, which really wouldn't have happened before. So, you know, there was a bridge where Aspire really kind of came in and helped her kind of find a foothold again.
Undine, did you feel hopeless?
Well, I kind of put it in the back of my mind because you know, it was not a fun time for me. And right now, I don't really remember how I felt. I just remember holding myself up in my room, not really speaking to anybody about it, and just you know, being on my computer, browsing the internet, doing stuff. Still getting, you know, my confidence back. Slow, but it's getting there.
And now?
So I'm still... Well, last semester, I aced everything, which was a pleasant surprise. I myself thought I was going to get B's and C's, but yeah, it turned out to be A's.
Oh, that's great. All right, so you're in this program called Aspire. What do you think it's done for you, and what do you aspire to be?
Well, I've always been interested in like medical sciences, especially with human anatomy. So it also helped with me seeing like what a hospital setting really is like for, you know, employers, because then I've never really been in one. And it's also helped with communicating with bosses and people above you.
You want to be a doctor?
No, I don't want to be a doctor. I want to be a medical examiner.
You mean like a coroner?
Yeah.
Okay. That's
my ideal job.
That's a room with no distractions.
Nope, not at all.
Undine, yeah. The best of luck to you, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Jennifer, would you like to give us some closing thoughts?
I think that stories like Undine's really show what people on the autism spectrum can do when they're given the right supports, and that they really can thrive. And so really, I think the time that we're in presents this unique opportunity where we have this whole cohort of people with a lot to offer the world, and we have a chance to really help them succeed and become fully participating members of citizens of the world. How are we going to respond to that challenge? And what I'm hoping is that with more programs like Aspire's, we're going to respond by giving the supports and the services that this group needs and then letting them take it from there. I'm really encouraged to see that happening.
Jennifer Richler, science writer and clinical psychologist in Bloomington, Indiana. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Undine Grosser, good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you.
And Mira Aker, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow, our conversation about being a woman online continues on our program and on a Twitter chat you can find out more about on thetakeaway.org, and you can even join. Plus, we want to hear about your experience online. From Portland, Oregon, I'm an internet minimalist. I think there is too much oversharing, but I live 3,000 miles away from most of my family, so I do appreciate Facebook as a means of keeping in touch.
Esther in Jacksonville, Florida. I avoid reading the comments on any post online because for every objective opinion, there seems to be a multitude of nasty, ignorant comments. I do not understand how so many people become such trolls online. Are they as nasty in real life? Makes me sad, and I avoid it.
We're not nasty. We'd love to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.